League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Milwaukee Journal sent on the Milwaukee Brewers podcast. We have a new name. We're calling ourselves Micro Brew. That's Mike, like, you know, microphone. It's not novel, but it is a new name. We've got a new look. If you could check out our logo, or if you care to check out our logo in all the usual podcast places, it's a new-ish dawn for our weekly Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the show, and on the other line is Brewers reporter Kurt Hoge of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was there checking out the Brewers this week at home against the Chicago Cubs. Milwaukee takes 2 out of 3, coming off of a sweep of the Pittsburgh Pirates. It made for a 5-2 week of baseball. The Brewers are doing very well, but there's still some weird things to discuss. So, Kurt, this series in particular was, I think, really hard for at least me to wrap my arms around. The Brewers bust out the bats. They hit double digits the first night, 9 runs in game 2, and then they go ice cold quiet against Marcus Stroman, who had been struggling coming into this game, and the Brewers get shut out 2-0. Not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. It is one game, and the Brewers did just sweep the Pirates, as I mentioned, including another double digit run scoring performance on Tuesday night after they lost that one-off game against the Giants back at American Family Field between road trips. So it was a little bit of an adventure, but a great week overall. I guess I'm just wondering, this offense, I guess you have to say, is better. They're back. They scored a lot of runs. But it still feels like a struggle. Is that invented in my head? Like, what is your status report for the Milwaukee Brewers offense right now after this Sunday game against the Cubs?
Well, first off, I gotta say, I'm glad that you clarified that the mic in microbrew stands for microphone, because I was thinking it was for Mike Zagurski.
Yes, Mike Zagurski. I never did get an interview. I never interviewed him for back when I was doing interviews for this podcast. He would have been a really interesting guy.
I think he was here for one game, maybe two games. Not very long.
It was a short stay. It was not as short as like Ariel Pena. There have been shorter stays, but yes, Mike Zagurski, a deep cut. If you're a fan of the last 10 years of Brewers baseball and want to just pick out some names, that would be a deep, deep cut indeed.
Yeah, no, that's a guy to remember for sure. But in terms of the offense, I don't really know what to make of the last week. There's been, you know, like, you kind of expect some in between of, you know, like a 5-run game or a game where, you know, they maybe bloop some hits together and get 6 runs, or the offense looks good en route to getting 3-4 runs. But really, it's felt like complete feast or famine. They scored 12, they scored 11, they scored 9. And then when they weren't scoring those, it was like either, you know, they got shut out today, or they got 2, which was enough to win in some of these games, or they got 2 in a loss, or they got 3. So it's like, what do you make of that? And part of it's just like, that's just how baseball is sometimes. And I still don't think the offense is particularly great, maybe even not even particularly good. But you did get the flashes of like, oh, these guys look, you know, these guys look like they can break out the bat. So it's still early. I don't know at what point I'll feel comfortable giving a full synopsis or, you know, valuation of the offense. But it's just hit or miss right now.
Yeah, this game against the Cubs on Friday is particularly interesting to me because the Brewers hit 6 home runs, which if you had told me they hit 6 home runs in a week of baseball prior to that game, I would have said, yeah, okay, that seems about right. I mean, there probably are weeks where they'll hit fewer. And you wrote about this at jsonline.com a little bit about one of the bigger issues right now in baseball is the restricted flight of the baseball, the humidors in every stadium, and the just changes to the baseball that seem to have created, even though Major League Baseball won't outright say it, seems to have created a deflation of offense, for lack of a better term. And you see it with fly ball after fly ball after fly ball going to the warning track and dying there. And we saw it in the Pirates series, especially a lot of well-struck balls, both sides. And they just, you know, it gets to a point where you're watching baseball and you see a guy take a swing that you would normally think, oh, wow, that's a home run. And it just dies. And you just assume it now. It's not probably not going to go out. And then the Brewers hit six in a game, including Jace Peterson off the top of the wall, which seems like the only way you could get it out. But then they just started pounding them left and right, including a couple swings that didn't look like home runs to me at first. So I don't, maybe it was a totally different baseball in that game. I have no idea. But something clicked, I guess, from the broader standpoint of the baseball and the way that it's impacting the league wide. I'd be curious your take on that. I mean, I think it's probably overstated to a degree how much impact that has. I think we'll probably still see plenty of home runs as the weather warms up. That always seems to be a element in play, the weather that we bring up when this sort of thing happens. But it also seems to me like we are going to be in an era where there is less offense. There are fewer home runs, and you're just not going to get that instant offense. You're going to have to string together four hits in a row like they did on Thursday against the Pirates to steal a game in the ninth inning. Like, that's you're going to have more of that. Do you think we're going to see things fall somewhat back to normal at some point this season, or do you see this as being a long-term thing?
Well, that's sort of like the catch-22 of the whole baseball, the ball itself situation, is that it clearly is not moving like we're used to, not traveling like we're used to. And some of that's the humidor, and some of that, you know, seems to be, this is a different ball. It's incredibly difficult also in today's game to string together three, four hits just with the way pitchers pitch and the way that shifts are. Like, it's incredibly difficult to play small ball and have success multiple times per game playing that way. So the home run remains king, right? But here's the caveat of, oh, it's really difficult right now to hit home runs. So it's just kind of a run-suppressing environment in general. It was funny on Friday to, like, it almost felt like in the middle of the game, the ball started traveling more. The ball Jace Peterson hit out did not. You know, in the stadium, there's been a bunch of balls were off the bat. I'm like, oh, that's probably gone. And then it dies at the warning track. Peterson's off the bat. I thought, I might make it to the warning track. And it just kind of kept spinning on out. Hunter Renfro backspun a couple out to right field. So it's just strange. I would not at all be surprised if whether it's because of the ball or not getting swapped out or changed or whatnot, come June, you know, that time of year, all of a sudden you're gonna start seeing some more home runs, because hitters are getting pretty frustrated with when they hit a ball that they know, you know, from throughout their entire career of hitting baseballs, are like, that's a home run, and it doesn't make it out. It's just become an incredibly frustrating thing for an entire league of position players.
Yeah, and you wrote specifically about Rowdy Tellez having a couple of those, and then you mentioned it to him, asked him if he thought one of his in particular was gone in Pittsburgh, and he basically was like, yeah, what do you think? It looked like it was gone. It sounded gone. It went a long way, but not far enough, and that just seems to be the nature of the beast right now. So the Brewers are not built necessarily to be an offensive juggernaut anyway, so that's not really news to the people of Milwaukee. Their pitching has been holding up beautifully, and that is by design. In fact, I find it quite ironic that the Brewers went 5-2 this week, and somehow the two losses were both starts by Corbin Burnes, and not because Corbin Burnes was struggling. The man, you know, generated, what, 26 swing and misses in his start against the Giants and went 6.5 scoreless, only to have the Giants come back and score some runs off the bullpen. And then in Sunday's game, I mean, he gave up a couple runs, but his offense gave him nothing. He lost 2-0. Like, there was just nothing he could do. He threw retired the first 13 men in a row, like, and with the efficiency he was doing it, you had to start thinking about a perfect game scenario. That's just how good he is. But so many other pitchers on this staff doing their job, and Eric Lauer in particular has really risen to the forefront here. That's back-to-back double-digit strikeout performances by him. He had 13 strikeouts in his last outing. That was the most of any left-hander in Brewers history, aside from Teddy Higuera, who is unquestionably the best left-handed pitcher in Brewers history, or at least among starters. Funny enough, we'll be talking about another one a little later. But then he comes back and does the same thing again. You know, I think it was Adam McAlvey. Somebody had a tweet that said the words very early Cy Young, Eric Lauer. And honestly, I had never put that together, mainly because there are other guys on this staff that I think are, like, still Cy Young, legitimate Cy Young candidates. But Eric Lauer, I guess, like, early on, you can't deny it. And going back to midway through last year, undeniable what this guy has done. I know he's added velocity. But, I mean, is that legitimate? Like, do you really think, like, at some point, June, July, we could still be looking at Eric Lauer and saying, the guy's got a chance here to be that level of pitcher in the National League?
It's funny that you asked that question, because someone else asked me the same thing today. Is this legit from Eric Lauer? And my answer was, you know, if you had asked me this maybe before the start of the season about his second half, I would have been a little more non-committal about it. But I was like, I can't come up with a reason why it wouldn't be. You know, the guy is, I think, second in all of baseball in swings and misses generated by his four-seamer, which, like, if I'm looking for something for, you know, a sign that a pitcher's breakout is legit, it's that he's getting lots of swings and misses with his primary stuff. And that's exactly what he's doing. Now, he's been really good going back to late June of last year. I mean, there's that stat of the top, I think I tweeted it out, the top, you know, the top ERAs in all of baseball for the last 4 months, and three of the top five are Brewers, and Eric Lauer's right up there. So it's been sustained, and now he's adding this velocity. He's adding the swing and miss. He's become a legitimate strikeout pitcher. His strikeout rate might still be higher than Corbin Burns. I'm not sure after today's start, but it was going into it. And I know that's only through four turns of the rotation, but, like, I don't know if we want to start, you know, Cy Young conversations through four starts. If it's that type of legit, but it's kind of reminiscent to, like, when Corbin Burns was starting to turn the corner, in whether you want to put that in 2020.
Absolutely.
or even last year a little bit, when it's been sustained to the point of, like, okay, this has been going on long enough and looks legitimate enough to buy into it.
Yeah, exactly who I thought of was Corbin Burns, a guy that, you know, 2020 happened and you still come into 2021 and you're like, are we sure that's what that was? Are we sure that he turned this massive corner, or was it just such a small sample that we couldn't really tell? And Todd was saying last week, Todd Rosiak was saying, you know, maybe Eric Lauer, more than others, had a little difficulty buying into some of the things that they teach in the Brewers with the pitching lab and everything else. And, you know, maybe with the COVID thing he faced last year and I think a little bit of injury along the way, like, maybe that slowed down what he was capable of doing. But now he's here, he's comfortable, and obviously he's got this newfound velocity, and that seems to be really helping his cause. So he's awesome. Aaron Ashby is participating in one-hitters. Fascinating game that I did not realize was a one-hitter for the vast majority of it. I mean, I knew that the no-hitter was over. That was on an infield single that Mike Brasso tried to make a diving play on, bounced off his glove. Clear-cut hit wasn't really in question, although anytime you have a scoring decision in Pittsburgh or one hit in Pittsburgh, you can raise an eyebrow. But Aaron Ashby and the bullpen finish off this one-hitter, and the Brewers have now had four of those in four straight years of at least one of those. And Aaron Ashby also looks legit. And I think there's probably still a lot of learning, a lot of growing left for him to do. But again, like, that's your number six guy. That's the number six option for this pitching staff. As you, what you've seen from him, what stands out to you as you look at Aaron Ashby? Does it look like he's getting more and more comfortable the more you watch him pitch?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff, you could legitimately argue it's the best stuff on the staff. And that's a staff with Corbin Burns. I mean, like, there's wild. Just so much movement, even on that sinker. It just moves arm side so much. The question with him is always going to be the walks, and there will always be some semblance of walks just because his stuff moves so much. It's kind of difficult to command it. But I think he's almost averaging a walk per inning, which is, and he'll tell you this, it's just too much at this level. He hasn't been burned by the walks yet a whole lot. He gets a lot of ground balls, he gets a lot of strikeouts, which, We'll always help him out in that regard, but he's settling in. I mean, it's tough because he's kind of in this fluctuating role right now. Right now, I think they've got their probable starters lined up for the next series. I don't think he's in it. I think they might be going back to the five man for the time being, with the roster shrinking and kind of having some, you know, Jake Cousins to the IL and some other things going on where they probably want to keep some guys in the bullpen, that he'll probably be going back to the bullpen for the short time being anyway. But either way, like, Aaron Ashby is starting to figure it out at the big league level. And that's a really tough thing to do, but this stuff absolutely plays up, and you can't help but see that.
All right, so let's talk about the roster moves that you're mentioning there on Sunday after the game. First of all, the Brewers know that they're going to be reducing from 28 to 26 players. That's a league-wide change that, again, it was expanded for roughly the first month of the season, coming out of a very shortened spring training as a means of kind of keeping everybody healthy. And now the Brewers are facing a couple cuts. They did make a couple moves. Mike Brasso goes back to AAA Nashville at the end of Sunday's game. And Alex Jackson, catcher who came up midweek because Victor Caratini went on the COVID IL. They needed a backup catcher. Alex Jackson, by the way, acquitting himself beautifully. The team just acquired him. So it was like a smaller version of what Victor Caratini went through, where he had to show up and learn a pitching staff right away. Certainly Alex Jackson had to do the same thing this week, and he hit the ball pretty well. But he goes back to AAA because presumably Caratini will be back, and Luis Urias will hopefully be joining this team sometime this week, coming off of his rehab assignment, and it's be pretty much the starting third baseman at that point. But there's a couple more moves to be made, and Jake Cousins going on the IL. You mentioned that as we record this on Sunday night. I wasn't even aware of that, or I missed that, which is entirely possible from earlier in the day. So what moves are going to be made, and is it as simple as they're going to find guys with options and send them down, because it's probably too early to truly make a stronger judgment on a player? Or, you know, like Jose Urania has struggled a little bit. Is that a route? Like, how are they going to approach this, do you reckon?
Well, they've got one move left to make, if you kind of think about it, and that's with the activation of Luis Urias, because they sent two guys down, so the roster technically, as we speak, is at 26, but you kind of put the pieces together. They talked about, you know, getting Urias through the weekend and then reevaluating, and hopefully he could be back starting with the Red Series on Tuesday. He played today. The Brewers were non-committal. Post-game, Craig Counsell was about, you know, whether he would be back, but they were going to talk about it. So with Mike Brasso going down, that's a right-handed third baseman. Urias is a right-handed third baseman, so he'll probably be activated once they can kind of clear, you know, just make sure all the I's are dotted in terms of his health and confirming all those things. So you'll have to send down one guy with Urias being activated, and the question is, does that come out of the bullpen? They just did lose Jake Cousins to the IL and did not call any pitchers up in his place, so they would be down two pitchers if they do send someone down. They'd probably be a guy like Hobie Milner, who has minor league options. Urania is an option, but cutting bait with him kind of when he's just in a, you know, eating innings role on a major league contract probably is not the most Brewers thing to do. So that's the way I think they'll go with it. They could send down another bat, which would probably be, Kesson Hira at this point. And I just don't think that's probably the way they'll go. So I think it'll be a bullpen arm.
Yeah, Kesson Hira actually is a guy that occurred to me. I still feel like if they want to reclaim that prospect status, unless they just think of him now as a guy who's going to come off the bench as a hitter and a part-time role player, either at first base, second base, whatever, DH. I know they tried him in the outfield. We haven't seen that this year, but if that's how they think of him, then fine, he should stay. If not, it seems like maybe getting him a full-time role to try and freshen him, you know, sharpen him up, I guess, would be good, although he has done that before and raked at AAA, and it hasn't translated, so it's not like necessarily that's going to be the fix there. But I think you're right with everything you said there. That makes sense to me. I think that if this were May or June, there might be some different decision making being made, but you know, you're not going to you know, for example, Jace Peterson has really struggled. You're not going to cut bait though with that guy, knowing that he doesn't have options left and he is left-handed, capable of playing a few positions. You're not going to cut bait with him after 3 weeks. You know, you're going to wait until May, June, July, but before, and maybe then is the time you say, okay, we probably need to move on or whatever. Certainly we're not there yet with a guy like him. So you know, I've got kind of a big picture question for you, and you know, we probably have made fun of this before. You and I are not really in the same age bracket. I'm in the middle age territory, and you're on the younger side. And baseball, of course, is very, very obsessed with courting that younger audience. And just a lot of things have been going on lately that have led me to wonder how someone like you or somebody in your age bracket sort of looks at baseball as a whole. And we talked about some of that, the home runs dying, you know, that's the suppressed offense is definitely something that I would be a little concerned about. For me personally, it does diminish my enjoyment of baseball in general, not necessarily when it comes to Brewers, which I'm always going to be interested in, but just in general, it's not, you know, I want to see home runs. They're fun. They're something that I think a lot of fans grow to enjoy. But also part of suppressing the home run offense is the intent of just generating more in-play offense, you know, singles, doubles, triples, the holy grail, the exciting triple, which is not something that can just be sort of artificially generated. But, you know, I understand why baseball in making moves such as plans to obliterate the shift or add a pitch clock, like I understand those moves because I understand that in-play baseball is also something that's very exciting. A couple other things that just came up. There was a combined no-hitter over the weekend, the New York Mets and maybe six pitchers, I don't actually know for sure, five, six, threw a combined no-hitter. Those are very common now. Last year, famously, the record for most no-hitters in a season, I think there were nine of them. I'm totally off the top of my head. I don't know if that's true, but it was a number like that. Probably going to be that again this year, and probably more than half of them will be combined no-hitters. The idea of the singular no-hitter is essentially, I don't want to say it's over, but it's going to take an ultra-efficient performance to actually have more of those. And then Miguel Cabrera getting 3,000 hits, also a cool thing that happened this past week for the Tigers. We're going to go a decade before we see somebody get that again. You know, Mike Trout, maybe. There's a couple other candidates, Jose Altuve, but you know, this is not something that's going to happen. These things that I grew up with as thinking they were kind of like the greatest moments, 3,000 hits, no hitters, a lot of offense. Like, those things aren't really in play right now, and I think part of baseball's problem is that, existentially speaking, when it's played at its best, at its most, like, you know, well-calibrated, you've got guys striking, everybody's striking out, nobody's hitting for average because average isn't as important as power. So you wind up with a product that isn't very good, even though it is technically being played perfectly. No one's stealing bases because it's an inefficient thing to do. So that's a problem baseball has to be dealing with at all times. Very long-winded, and I threw a lot of stuff at you, but I guess my ultimate question is, do you think baseball is still fun? Can it court a younger audience, somebody in your age group, for example? Because it's got, I think, kind of some problems right now.
Baseball is the best sport. That's my personal take on it. It's just the best. And I personally am able to find enjoyment even in a high strikeout era. Like, if you can't appreciate, you know, as a neutral observer tuning into a Corbin Burnes start or watching Carlos Rodon strike out, you know, 12 guys or whatever, like, that beats to me a guy who's, you know, who's pitching well but by pitching to contact, so to speak. So I wouldn't mind a little more action in the game. I think, you know, and part of what dawned on me recently was, like, when runners get on scoring position into scoring position, there's no level of concern really about, like, oh, you know, a single could bring him in, because they're just so rare. It's like, he's in scoring position. What really matters there is that he's on base, you know, for an extra base hit, or like, but then again, they're like, the pitcher could probably just strike out these next two guys. So, like, there was always just that element of more things could happen, some more danger, some more excitement, with some base hits. So I think I've come around a little on getting a little more action with balls in play, but I don't know how exactly you combat that with just how good pitchers are. Like, hitting has to catch up at some point, but we're not there yet. So I don't know, just being able to enjoy the Ohtanis and the Corbin Burnes and all those guys that are out there just dominating at their specific craft is sort of how I've adapted to enjoying it. Like, there's just a lot more. I mean, when Randy Johnson was pitching, it was awesome to watch him go out there and strike everyone out. Now there's just a bunch of guys that are doing that, and so it's a tricky process for MLB to navigate. But I don't know. I guess there's contentment in the current state is kind of how I approach things, even though it's far from a perfect product.
Yeah, and as far as hitters adjusting, feel like they would have done that by now. You know, it's been a long time where we've had pitchers that close to this level, and shifts have been happening now for several years. Hitters aren't getting better at it. It's either because of how they're you know, sort of raised through the minor league system, or just what they're good at or what teams are looking for and evaluating. But people, if you want to beat the shift, you'd think, yo, just hit it opposite field. Well, no, most people are still trying to hit it through the shift. That just seems to be what's happening. So I understand baseball's interest in that. But I also, I mean, I, from a perfectly biased standpoint, still agree with you. Baseball is the best sport, and I do still enjoy it. But it is, I understand the struggle that it's going through right now. This is a very weird time. The Brewers are 15-8. They are two games ahead of the Cardinals in the NL Central, and they welcome in the Cincinnati Reds this week into American Family Field. They are a breathtaking 3-19 to start the season. It has all fallen apart in Cincinnati. So the Brewers. Theoretically, should be able to make more hay. You never know. Every game is a new challenge in Major League Baseball. But after that, they go to Atlanta. Ronald Acuna is back for the Braves. It is a rematch of the NLDS from this past season in 2021. Start of a three-city road trip for the Brewers. So that's what is ahead. And it should be another split week for the Brewers with half home, half road. Let's get to our three up, three down, Kurt, where we look at some of the individual things, the smaller things that happened for the Milwaukee Brewers this week. If you want to start, feel free. Otherwise, I can kick it off. Where do you want to start with this?
Go ahead and lead us off here, JR.
All right. So I think we'll start with some action near the dugout defensively. Couple plays. Jace Peterson, and I think this was on Tuesday, ran over to like make a kick save on a ball that had glanced off. I'm sure it was Tuesday because it hit off Brandon Woodruff straight up off his leg and toward the dugout. And Jace Peterson came over to basically make a kick save to keep it out of the dugout and save an extra base, which I thought was very impressive. Brewers won that game. And then Mike Brasso also had a moment. And you know what? I've already forgotten which game this was. I think this might have been Friday night where he was over by the visiting dugout. The ball was, he was trying to make a catch. He made the catch with like 1 foot in bounds essentially before he ran down the steps of the visiting dugout. I'm drawing a blank if that was actually in Pittsburgh or in Milwaukee, but I think the latter. And it was impressive stuff. So the Brewers with some action near the dugout, some unusual defensive plays to make some things happen and winning both those games. So it definitely worked out.
I will start off. We talked a little bit about the dead ball, and you mentioned I wrote about Rowdy Tellez had been hurt. Statistically speaking, more than any other Brewer, but I think the guy who has gotten most frustrated, at least visibly, has been Andrew McCutchen. He hit that homer leading off on, was that Thursday in Pittsburgh, and after the game said, you know, I hit it about as well as I could, and it barely scraped over. And then I think the very next day against the Cubs, he hit two balls to the warning track, and I think he thought he got more of them than the end result produced, and he looked pretty upset. So Andrew McCutchen also burned by the dead ball.
Let's talk about McCutchen again. The game on Thursday, a big time rally in Pittsburgh. McCutchen hits a home run on the very first pitch of the game. I did some research at the time. It could have been if it had ended 1-0, the second game in Brewers history in which a leadoff batter hit a home run accounting for the only run in a 1-0 win. And this would have been the first one on the road. It looked like that would be the case into the late innings before the Pirates rallied for a couple runs. And the Brewers went into the ninth down 2-1. They had one out, nobody on. And then they strung together those four singles. And McCutchen comes through with the big two-run single right over the glove of Josh Van Meter at second base. It was just an inch or two away, and if he catches that ball, he catches it for the second out, he'll quick throw to either second or first and get the runners that were charging on the play and easily ends that game, and the Brewers lose 2-1. Instead, it's just over his glove. 3-2, the Brewers end up winning. Devin Williams with a spectacular ninth inning to close that one down. So game of inches, it's just the way it goes. I would have bet my life that the Brewers would not have come through to win that game. Their offense had been pretty unimpressive that day, but they do it. They come back with a ninth inning rally and wind up winning 3-2. Big game.
I'll go to the Brewers outfield where Lorenzo Cain is on a torrid infield hit pace. He's coming into Sunday batting only 163. I don't think he played, so it'll stay at 163 with eight hits, but I believe five of those. I think Fangraphs has the number wrong. I looked each of them up, and there were five legitimate infield hits out of those eight hits, and I believe like his last four hits have all been infield singles. I think he had a one to the outfield, maybe maybe it was in Philadelphia, was his last hit to the that got to the outfield. So Lorenzo Cain, torrid infield singles hitter. The legs apparently are still working. The power has not shown up yet, but he's keeping that average. I mean, it's only 163, but he's keeping it somewhat respectable because he's able to leg those out.
Yeah, Lorenzo Cain, famous for his ability to kind of walk around like he looks like he's in great pain, and then, you know, suddenly the ball is an infield single possibility. He's busting it out of the box, running full fledged down the line, and gets there, and then immediately reverts to I'm an old man. The old man walk that he's got going on is very funny. My third one is Willy Adames. We got to talk about that game on Tuesday. You know, I had asked Craig Counsell after Monday's game. I was covering that game against the Giants because Adames homered in the eighth to briefly tie the game and give the Brewers some hope there before a two-run homer by Luis Gonzalez. First career home run by him, not the Luis Gonzalez from 20 years ago, new one, that made the difference, and the Giants won that game 4-2. But asked if maybe, you know, a no-doubt swing like that would maybe unlock what Willy Adames was going through in the early going. At that point, pretty much everybody in the offense was struggling. I don't think there was one person you could point to and say that person is doing well offensively. But, you know, this early in the season, all it takes is one good game. Willy Adames, two home runs the next night, seven RBIs, seven to certainly set a personal best with the Brewers, tie the franchise record for most RBIs for an individual in the game. Just wild stuff. And looked tremendous, had four hits. You know, it wasn't like a sustained breakout necessarily, but it certainly rewrote his numbers quite a bit. And it was great to see that really part of all this whole week, the six homer game, all of it, just shaking that off, that rust off that just, you know, seemed to be plaguing the bats. Certainly Willy Adames breaking out was part of it there.
Yeah. Speaking of the six homer game, it was just refreshing to see like the ball leave the yard a bunch. It was confusing, don't get me wrong, but it was enjoyable to just watch a baseball team hit a lot of homers, because I haven't seen Ben covered a lot of games this year and I've not seen many homers. Like, I think there was one combined in Philadelphia in a three-game set. So that is not my third part of the three up, three down. My third part of the three up, three down, let's go with Hunter Renfroe, who, after he hit an opposite field homer in Philadelphia, Will Salmon of The Athletic asked him kind of just about opposite field power. And he's like, basically like, yeah, home runs to right are not a part of my game at all. I'm trying to hit line drives out that way, but like power, you know, real power out that way, no, I don't really do that. And then, of course, yeah, Friday night, he bops two more to the opposite field, and it was like, yeah, he kind of just got lucky into backspinning him out there. But like, historically, if you look at his homer charts, it is not a big part of his game, but recently he's added it, it seems. So Hunter Renfroe, opposite field power hitter, question mark?
Yeah, maybe that's one way to combat the dead ball, is to find a new field to homer the, I mean, certainly it's easier at American Family Field to homer over that right field short deck, or whatever you want to call it, the party area, than it is to left. So maybe that's what he's working through. All right, that'll do it for the three up, three down. Shout out to the Colton Wong double play that took place on Wednesday in the sixth inning to kind of keep the Pirates from doing worse damage. Very flashy, typical great Colton Wong defense that we didn't mention here. All right, let's go to Remember When.
Red Hot Memories, High School Days.
A little brief history lesson, usually something maybe you don't know about Brewers history, as we dig through. And the topic here involving saves, Josh Hader moving into a tie for second place in franchise history with in saves. He's tied now with John Axford. He still has to catch one Dan Plesac, the all-time, that left-hander that I mentioned at the very outset. There was Teddy Higuera as a starter. There's Dan Plesac out of the bullpen. But Dan Plesac, a lot of people may know him as an analyst. He pops up on game calls every once in a while, MLB Network. But he's the all-time saves leader in Brewers history and was a very effective reliever. But there was one game in particular I wanted to point out, and it was June 22nd, 1990, Brewers MasterCard seat cushion night, a free seat cushion.
Oh, that's
to
a
the
night.
First 35,000 fans, 15 and over. Seat cushions, popular giveaway back in the day. Not so much now, but I think a lot of fans remember Brewers had a baseball night where the baseballs all got thrown onto the field. This is a much smaller version of that. The seat cushions were not even thrown onto the field necessarily, but This is a game where the Brewers had 16 hits. They were had a comfortable lead against Cleveland. The bullpen starts to blow it. And so it was a 9-4 lead. It becomes a 9-7 lead. And Dan Plesac is brought in the game with a two-run lead, runner at third. And actually, he gets the last out. Jerry Brown lines out to Greg Brock to end the game. And it had been drizzling, sprinkling all night long. Giant downpour begins right after that. But the fans that are left are wet. They're probably pretty unhappy. And the Brewers are losing this game. They're a sub-500 baseball team at this point. And what happened is they just started smacking the seat cushions against anything, against other seats, against each other, just like making all this loud, clamoring noise because they were getting so frustrated with how things were going on the field. And so apparently it was just booming loud inside County Stadium as Dan Plesac finally gets that last out just ahead of this massive rain shower. So an interesting night, one that I had not heard of before someone brought it to my attention. But for those who don't know a lot about Dan Plesac, that's a three-time All-Star, 3 years in a row. He made the All-Star team. He broke the record for saves in 1989. That was a single season record when he got 33. Many people have surpassed that at this point. He did give up Cecil Fielder's gargantuan home run that traveled 520 feet. I think a lot of people remember or at least have seen the highlight of that out of County Stadium, just into the parking lot in 1991. That's a year where they tried Plesac as a starter. He'd been in the bullpen for many years and, you know, like you hear now when there's a young reliever who's doing very well, like, are you going to try to start him? Well, they tried to start him. It didn't really work out. He had like a 4.29 ERA that year, but he made like 10 starts in 1991 and only had 8 saves. But he did actually rebound, had a really nice 1992. He had an ERA under 3, became a Cub thereafter for a couple seasons, went to Pittsburgh, a couple other teams after that, Toronto, Arizona, Philly. But he was a solid rookie in 86 and had a really good 5-6 seasons in Milwaukee. And, you know, he doesn't have a huge save total. I think it's like 124 that is his career save total. I mean, Francisco Cordero had like 43 of them 1 year. And you figure that's like 3 good seasons of Francisco Cordero would be that record. So it's kind of a number that probably a lot of franchises have a higher mark on. But Josh Hader's going to get there. You know, this is his 6th season, and he didn't have any saves that first year. So being up to 106, tied with Axford, I mean, he's well on his way to doing that. But Dan Plesac is still around, still a part of Brewers lore a little bit, and a pretty nice reliever, and made it through this bizarre seat cushion night incident as well. Any thoughts? Do you have any connection to Dan Plesac?
I have no connection to Dan Plesac, but I do think it's interesting that they did try him out as a starter, and it's kind of a kudos credit to the Brewers for, you know, after that first year of Josh Hader, it was like, well, are you going to start him? No, we're just going to keep him as a reliever.
Yeah.
Really? You're not going to start him? No, we're just going to keep him as a reliever. And, well, you know, I think it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And police actually decided, oh, that's not what we want to do. So he actually probably could have racked up quite a few more saves. You know, he's sort of at the front end of when saves are a thing. It's part of why I would imagine for many franchises that career saves mark is a little bit low, because, you know, there haven't been many times where you've had guys, you know, in the 80s and 70s that were racking these up. By the way, it's 133 is the career mark for Dan Plesac. So Josh Hader will be threatening that mark probably this year, I think, toward the end of the year. So that'll be something maybe to watch as the year goes on. All right, let's wrap this up.
Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep.
It's the final take of the podcast episode here. We call it Todd's Take when Todd is the one on the other line, but it's you, Kurt Hoag. So, Kurt Blanche, give us your final take of the week here as we wrap this up.
All right, I got something for you here. I have a bone to pick with some baseball rules. Now, there's a few of them that are kind of wonky, don't make a whole lot of sense. The drop third strike, I mean, like, logically, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I don't really mind it because it doesn't happen much, and it's kind of just a weird, quirky play, whatever. The one that really bothers me is the ground rule double rule, particularly with two outs.
Okay.
On a ball that is hit to the wall, it bounces and then goes over the wall, but it's hit to the wall on two outs. You know, that ball's hitting the air, the runner's on, and there's a runner on first. That runner should be allowed to score.
Yeah.
How many times, you know, even with you or I running, if we get a head start when the ball is hit, we're halfway to third by the time that ball goes over the wall. It just makes no sense to me. I would venture to guess with a runner on first, and I could probably look this up, but with a runner on first and two outs on doubles to the wall that stay in play, the runner probably scores like 85-90% of the time. Why are we holding him at third? It makes no sense. You're suppressing offense for particularly no reason. You know, the pitcher just gave up a 320-foot fly ball line drive. Why does he get the benefit of the doubt here? This is just something that needs reform.
Yeah, I would push back on me running as in this particular example. I feel like maybe I only make it to third, but I agree with you in principle. Now, I think for me, it's less about saying he should definitely score from first, the runner, if it is a ground rule double. I am all in favor of just giving some freedom to the umpires to make that decision. I don't know if you can quite go as far as saying if the runner is slow, you know, maybe you can change your mind on that and just give them third base. But the umpires can see where the runner is when that ball is struck or when that ball bounces. I mean, I think you're right. Even if there's not two outs, the vast majority of runners on a booming double that goes to the warning track and bounces over, the vast majority are going to score. Now, you could also argue, well, they might score, but there's also going to be a play at the plate, which you're robbing the defense of if you are simply awarding them the, you know, home plate. So I can understand that too. I just think umpires should be given more leeway. It shouldn't be cemented in stone. And if you want more offense, you know, make those exciting. You know, yeah, it's a bummer that it bounces over the wall. It's kind of a quirk in the game of baseball. You can't raise up the fences. So I could see why that's just, it's just sort of bad luck, sort of random, but just, I don't know. Let umpires say, you know what, that dude was motoring around second before that ball even landed. You got to give him home plate.
I don't know. I want less umpire involvement.
Yeah, I hear ya. I hear ya.
Give them less arbitrary decisions.
Yeah, you know, it's probably an unfair thing to say, to have somebody on the field try to evaluate where a runner is when that ball goes over the fence. But there are so many occasions where it's just like, oh, that booming shot happened to land just right, and it ended up favoring the defense, even though the defense got scorched because it happened to bounce over, as opposed to just nicking the top of the wall and staying in play, which thus allowed a run to score. I hear you, Kurt. I'm with you on that. Have we seen any of those? I'm trying to think. Have we had any ground rule doubles this season with the Brewers?
Not many ground rule doubles just in general. I mean, just not a lot of them. And I have not seen this play come up really in any game I've watched at all. I'm sure it has. But it certainly, one of these days, it'll like cost a team a big playoff game. And I'll be ahead of the curve on the complaints about it. So I feel good about that.
All right, sounds good. Again, the Brewers get an off day for the second time all year on Monday, and then they stay at home. Cincinnati Reds coming into town before they hit the road for a 3-series road trip. Kurt Hoge will be part of that road trip, part of the home coverage as well. Read everything he has at jsonline.com. Oh, you'll even have a little me again this week. Cinco de Mayo game against the Reds, that getaway day game. I'll be on the clock for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Microbrew. New name, new logo. I love the logo. I'm really excited about the logo. I don't even care about the name. The logo is great. So we're excited about that. And thanks for tuning in, Kurt. Appreciate you joining us this week. We'll chat with you again very soon.
Yes, sir. Mike Zagurski. Everybody.
A needless Mike Zagurski reference to open and close this podcast. That is what we're talking about. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will chat with you again next week. Bye-bye.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.